Hope everyone had a meaningful.
Yamim Narayim. Thank God I did. Ready to jump into the festivities. So I wanted to talk about, really, we're getting now into Siman Zion, section 7 of the first, hold on just 1 second. Okay. We're getting into Siman. Siman Zayin of Choshen Mishpat, which is section 7. We're getting into some of the more juicy topics now. And by juicy topics, I'm referring to who is invalid to officiate on a Beit Din and why. So I want to try to hit three topics now. The first topic is the invalidity of converts. That's topic number one. Topic number two, the invalidity of women to serve as Dayanim. And number three is slightly more on the philosophical side, but it is nonetheless brought in the halachic literature of the qualities that a person that we are meant to seek out in the people that are serving this function. So let's just jump right in. I'm sharing my screen. People can see the sources over here.
Yeah, can you make it slightly bigger?
Can I make it slightly bigger? Let me see. Having some difficulty enlarging it. Well, we'll do our best. Let me see. Hold on.
If you can't, you can't. No big deal.
Yeah. Okay, fine. So we'll skip that for the time being. So this is source number one. Source number one is the Gemara in Yevamot. It says Amar Rava Ger Danes Chavero Dvar Torah, that a convert is allowed to judge a case if the litigant is a convert. Shenemar, as it says, Som Tasim Alecha Melech Asher Yivchar Hashem Elokecha, you will place upon yourself a king. Mikarev Achicha Tasim Alecha Melech, from amongst your brothers you will place upon yourself a king. Okay? Alecha Hu Deba'inan Mikarev Achicha. So we see that a person that the appointment needs to be from amongst your brothers. Aval ger danes chavero ger. However, if the litigant is a convert himself, it's permissible for the dayan to be a ger. Now, just off the bat, there's a question that stands out over here. The proof text that the Gemara brings that a dayan is invalid is the pasuk relating to a king, as it says, "Mikarav achicha tasim alecha melech," that you will put yourself a king from amongst your brothers. So this already highlights a very, very important point, which is going to be a running theme. I think in general, we've realized that there's a lot of overlapping themes that really it's very, very difficult to have any understanding at all, let alone a deep understanding, without having multiple concepts that we're holding simultaneously. And that's why we're trying to do our best to explain each concept somewhat independently as we get to it. But this is a very, very important idea. And the idea is that the position of a dayan is this melding of two types of leadership roles. The first type of leadership role is like a semi-political role, meaning it's a position of authority. It's not political like a policy maker, like a person who's sitting in the Senate or the parliament and deliberating over policy decisions, but political in the sense that they have authority. They have political authority. They are able to use force if necessary in order to mete out certain decisions. So that's one side of the dayan role. The other side of the dayan role, which we will actually discuss in a moment, or at least bring it up because it'll be important, is the teacher of Torah role. The dayan is an amalgamation of the authority figure and the teacher of Torah. So the fact that the dayan has this role of not just someone who's teaching Torah, giving over the halacha, but someone who's also giving over authority. He has an authority position. So this text involving a king is actually very, very relevant. And as the Gemara says in a few places, kol simos sha'atasam alecha, any application of authority that you put upon yourself, must be from amongst your brothers. So it's not just a king, like the specific position of a king, which, as we said in the past, the king and the court system are two very, very distinct, let's say, branches of authority in the... Yes.
I think there's Gemaras that refer to even appointing someone sort of in charge of the waterworks. I mean,
correct. Exactly.
Any position of authority.
Yes. Yes. It's the same. That's the same source that I'm referring to. It's called Simot, Shata Samalecha. Any positions of authority that you place amongst yourself have to be from amongst your brothers. Now,
but
let's
it seems
just
a little unfortunate because if he'd be the best guy for the job, I mean, wouldn't you want the best surgeon, the head of the surgery department, rather than a bunch of others who happen to have a lot of malpractice suits on them? And then to say, I can't use him because this is a, he's a convert.
Right. So it's very good that you brought
this. It would have been against basic logic.
So it's very good that you brought that up. It's very good that you brought that up. So let's lay out the logic for this. First of all, you gave the example of a surgeon, someone who their role is very, very practical, meaning we have them in order to fulfill a certain service. We want the surgeon to be able to cut people up and sew them back together as best as possible. The plumber, we want to be able to fix
the department
as well as possible.
I mean, he's the boss. He's the boss.
So there's I don't think that what we would call administrative roles today, like a guy who works in the Misrad HaPnim or the guy who has a position in, you know, the this governmental office or that governmental office, that's not what it's talking about over here. We're talking about someone who has authority, meaning they have executive authority. They have executive authority over policy decisions. That's what it means. It doesn't mean someone who's hired by the agency to perform a certain role. That could be anyone. We're talking about someone who's like the head of the department. How would you make that distinction? I guess the devil is in the details in each case upon its merits. But we're not talking about, you know, people that work in the offices. We're talking about the heads of the offices, basically. That's the general distinction. But just to address the question that you raised, because it's an important question, it's important to address these things and to be as explicit as possible. From Chazal and the relevant Mefarshim, there are two general reasons that arise for what the basis of this prohibition of a ger is. Why is it that we can't have a ger? And in a moment, we're going to look at a very, very very interesting example from Jewish history that throws a little bit of a wrench into this whole thing. But before we do that, let's just set out the two reasons that are given. The first reason is in terms of the public perception. Public perception is that we want people to be in charge, that the public that they have authority over can have a certain level of resonance with them, that the public feels that they're amongst them. It's not some outsider that's coming in and running the show, but rather it's from amongst us. And this is very, very important. This is a factor that we need to factor in when we're setting up a government. It's not just, as you said, Bruce, that we want the best guy. For sure, it's important that there are competent people in charge. But the other consideration is that the people that are being ruled over, the people that are being told what the rules are, and they're being, you know, controlled to one extent or another by these people, it's important that they feel a resonance with them. It's very, very important. This is super critical. And if that doesn't exist, then there could be a breakdown in the system as such, not just in terms of the competence of the individuals in the positions, but in the system as a whole, there could be a breakdown. So in order to avoid this problem, there is a blanket prohibition against any foreigner. A ger, as we know, it doesn't just mean a convert in the strict sense. It means any foreigner. It means someone who's not from the Jewish people. That's reason number one. Reason number two, which goes a little bit more to the consideration of the convert, him or herself. And what's that consideration? We want to make sure that the people that are joining the Jewish people are not doing it for any alternative motives. That is a very, very important point. They know that when they come in, they're going to say, listen, you can join. You could be part of this whole operation. You could be part of this whole enterprise. And we love you and we accept you. That's great. But we want to make sure that you understand you're not coming in here in order to be in charge. All right. There's a very well-known story from the Gemara in Shabbat that there's a convert that comes to Shammai and Hillel. There's a few stories of that, like the convert in the Amah Aretz. First he goes to Shammai and then he goes to Hillel. Right? There's a few stories like that. Right. So one of the stories is that this convert comes to Shammai and says, listen, I want you to convert me on the condition that I can be the high priest. Yeah. So it says that this guy saw the high priest one day, right? This non-Jew, he saw the high priest. He saw the, you know, the nice clothes and the tapestries and the gold and the, and the crimson that he's wearing and all that. And he says, I would like to be that. So he says, convert me on the condition that I can be the high priest. Now this story just highlights how people can come for alternative motives. Yeah. So in order to avoid that issue completely, you tell the convert, you can come, but you're not going to be in these positions of authority.
But I thought that along with that story, they have like a gadol hador who's a son of a convert.
So we're going to see in a moment. We're going to see in a moment. It's not only the son of a convert, but it's even more than that. Just wanted to read out one more source before we get to that. Yeah. So it should be clear that when we say convert, we don't just mean the convert themselves, but we mean the descendant of converts. Meaning this is a linear thing. Meaning once you have a convert, so the descendants of the converts are also invalid. Now the question is this from one parent or does it have to be from both parents? Meaning, if both parents are converts, then obviously that's a problem. But let's say one of the parents isn't a convert, so are their children invalid? So Tosfos on that gemara that we just read, that's a gemara from Yevamot and Daf Kuf Aleph. So Tosfos over there says that either the mother or the father, either the mother or the father can be from the Jewish people. He says, that which it says that the father and the mother have to be non-converts. Perish beimo lo sugi achi agam aviv mi Israel. It's not enough that his mother is Jewish; his father also has to be Jewish. Aval ba'aviv lechud sugi. But in fact, also with the father alone, it's also enough. Meaning, if the father is a regular Jew, so to speak, and the mother is a convert, that's fine. And what's the biggest raya that Tosfos brings, by the way, that the descendant of a convert woman and a Jewish man is allowed to occupy a position of authority is from Avshalom. Avshalom, we see, despite the fact that he was literally a rebel and that he tried to kill his own father, while at the time that he was in power, he was considered like halachically the king, meaning he got there by illegitimate reasons, but he was in fact the king. The Yerushalmi famously says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah, the Yerushalmi says an incredible thing. It says that while David HaMelech was running away from his son Avshalom, meaning at the time that he had been, you know, dislodged essentially by this coup, so he would not bring the sacrifice of a king. As we know, there are distinctions between certain sacrifices that a regular person brings and the Kohen Gadol brings and the king brings, right? But in order to be in that category, so to speak, that you're a king, that you bring the special sacrifice of a king, you have to be the king. So what's considered the king? The king means that you're in power. That's what it means, right? And even if you were anointed by the prophet, as David was, because he's not in power, so de facto he's not the king. So Avshalom was in fact the king during that period of time. So even though Avshalom's mother was a convert, as it makes clear in the story, right? Avshalom's mother was taken one of the battles that David waged, his many battles in his career as a warrior. And this woman came back and converted, and that was Avshalom's mother. So we see that it's enough that the father is Jewish and the mother is a convert. So just to clarify
How did David become king?
Well, David wasn't the son of a convert woman or man. Oh, you're saying he was the descendant of the convert woman. That's also a very good point. Yes, that's true. That's true. But his actual father and mother were regular Jews, so to speak.
It's very hypocritical.
So
we're taught to respect the ger and to honor the ger and the taking. And here you're clearly, saying, sorry.
Respect and honoring the ger does not mean that there can't be restrictions on how the ger operates in society, in order to maintain the general cohesion of the entire group.
Especially up front. I mean, there won't be any guys.
These are sacrifices that the ger makes. Listen, every ger, you know, this is not as relevant today. I mean, hopefully it will be relevant soon, but it was certainly relevant back then. Every convert that came into the Jewish people made a tremendous, tremendous sacrifice that they had no ancestral land. They had no ancestral land. So like you come in to the Jewish people, you're coming into this country, everyone has their little plot that they live off of, that they plant, that they're able to reap the agriculture from. And this ger has nothing. Right. And right, and we're told that we need to help this person. Does that mean that every single Jew needs to like chip in and give a piece of his land away so that this convert can have a piece of land? No, that's not how it works. The ger does take on a certain level of sacrifice in order to be part of the Jewish people. That's why we respect them so much. We respect them because of the sacrifice that they take. If there was no downside, so to speak, if there was no hardship that they take on for themselves in order to join the group, then okay, so it's not such a big deal, but it's from the very fact that they do take on this issue. Right? The first time that this happens, by the way, I don't want to get too far afield, but just to highlight this point because it is an important point. The first time that we find this schism in the Jewish people is way back in Parshas Emor, in Sefer Vayikra. We find at the very, very end of the Parsha that there's this story of the Mekalel, right, the blasphemer, and he goes out, he curses God's name, and he's put to death. Very sad story. All right, and what's the backdrop of this story? As the psukim already allude to, right? They hint to this, that his mother was Jewish and was raped by an Egyptian official. So his father is an Egyptian and his mother's Jewish. So he's Jewish technically, right? Not to get into all the details over there because it was before the Torah was given, and really it should have gone after the father. Like his identity goes after the father. That rule that if your mother is Jewish, then you're Jewish. That was only after the giving of the Torah. But this person is born in Egypt already. So if your father is Egyptian, that means you're Egyptian. And then that's why Rashi says over there, Melamed Shenis Gayer, that he converted. He converted because really he was an Egyptian. He was a total, complete Egyptian. But he decided he's going to convert. So we're talking about like a very special individual. This person, he decided to join a slave nation while they were enslaved. This is before Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is before Moshe came and told them that God is going to take you out with miracles. He decided he's going to join this slave nation. He made that commitment, right? And while they're in the Midbar, so he decides to set up his tent in the tribe of Dan because his mother is from Dan. And the Danites say,
basically Midrash. I mean, we don't really know. Do you feel that we really know this story?
I think this is a topic in and of itself. I think that there are many Midrashim that give the backdrop story to events in the Torah that we should take as literally true. And there are many examples of this.
We're retrojecting the idea even of conversion. I mean, all we did was let's join the people.
What do you mean conversion? Well, it says in the verses explicitly that his mother was Jewish and his father was Egyptian. So what that meant practically is that he was an Egyptian. That's what that means. He's an Egyptian. So how does he join the Jewish people? He decides he's going to join the Jewish people. We call that conversion today in this very technical, like halachic way, but just generally, you know, more broadly, organically, rather speaking, means he was an Egyptian and he decided he wants to join the Jewish people. That's what that means. Right? And the whole backstory about how, like, you know, he's the guy that Moshe kills and all that. Right? Okay, fine. You want to accept those details. You don't want to accept those details. The point is that we do see that this is the general story of this person, that he was an Egyptian and he decided that he wanted to join the Jewish people. And the whole discussion that ensues over there, people can look this up in their own time. At the end of Parshas Emor, so they bring this person after he curses the name of God. They bring this person to Moshe because they don't know what to do with him. Again, this is all in the verses. This is not Midrash. They bring the person to Moshe. They don't know what to do with him. So Moshe comes. His response is the following. His response is to give them a whole lecture on the laws of civil damages, right? If your ox gores a guy, then you have to pay. But if he kills someone, you have to kill the ox, right? Et cetera, right? He just goes into all this stuff about civil law that seemingly doesn't have anything to do with anything that we're talking about, okay? But it's the last line, which is the punchline, so to speak. He says, Mishpat echad yelechem, you will have one law amongst you, kager ka'ezrach ba'aretz. The regular citizen and the foreigner are treated the same. That's the end of his whole lecture. So it's this whole lecture on civil law that ends off with this one line. And that's why he's bringing it up. He's saying, listen, it's true that this guy was a convert. It's true. He's a foreigner. That's true. And it's also true that he doesn't have a portion in a particular tribe because his father is not from the Jewish people. And your tribe goes through the patrilinear descent. But you couldn't have found some solution for this guy. You couldn't have found some solution for him. So it's like, right, it's speaking out this schism. The reason that I brought up this story now is because it is highlighting this, right, this fact, right? It is very, very difficult to be a convert, right? I'm sure we all know converts, and, right, to various degrees, they have their challenges of, right, integrating into the Jewish people. And it's because of those challenges that we respect them. It's not because it's easy. It's because it's hard.
Are we blaming Moshe for some kind of a fallacy here? I mean, Moshe supposedly assigns land near Jericho for the followers of his father-in-law. A whole parcel of land for the Kenites.
Right, that's true. So he gives them.
Why not assign him with the Kenites?
So it seems that that was a very special case. Because Jethro and his, it's not so clear if it was his father-in-law or his brother-in-law, but be that as it may, that because that family of Midianites was very unique, they provided assistance to the Jewish people while they were in the desert. So to that particular family of converts, and it's not so clear if they were even converts or they were like with the Jewish people, it seems the pshat of the psukim in Sefer Shmuel that they weren't actual converts. That's also how Chazal described them. They weren't really converts. They were like this. They were this minority of people living amongst the Jewish people, right?
So is it a stain on the each Beit Din of every Shevet that not one of them could find somewhere in the midbar part of the tent?
And yes, it absolutely is. And you can ask Rabbi Kowalski the next time that he speaks with you guys, because he has a whole thing on this, which he explained to me at length, that this incident occurred with the Danites. That he went to, you know, the tribe of Dan, and he said, "Listen, my mother's from Dan. I want to set up shop here." And they said, "Yeah, well, your father is a guy, so get out." So, right. So later on in history, we see that the Danites in Sefer Shoftim, in the Book of Judges, they have a huge crisis with their territory. If you remember that in the Book of Judges, they're not able to conquer their whole territory that was allotted to them by Joshua, and they have to send out this marauding party of like 600 bandits, essentially, to go steal whatever they can steal, basically. So it's like this major crisis for the tribe of Dan that they don't have a place, which is why
his grandson is sort of the punishment to, even though we're not supposed to punish descendants for the ancestors' behavior, but in a way Moshe's punished that his grandson.
That's another character in the story. The Menashe, right? The son of Menashe, so to speak, right? The Levite. So he's like the priest, the Avodah Zarah priest that they kind of take along. I'm just focusing on the Danites themselves. You have this marauding tribe of Danites. Why are they walking around the land like this? It's because they don't have enough of a place in their own allotted territory. So it's because they initiated this bad trait already in the desert that they couldn't find a place for someone who was desperate. So they themselves suffered from this problem. So it's like, it's what goes around comes around. If you begin with this type of behavior, so the pattern perpetuates and comes back to affect you. This is what the Torah is saying. Very, very important lesson. So I just wanted to move on and focus on this interesting point. Bruce already alluded to this, that we see very often, we see explicitly in Chazal that there were, you know, great sages that were connected in some way to the family of converts. Now I want to hone in on one particular example, because it's really, really quite fascinating, this particular example. The Gemara in Baba well, Unklus is probably the most famous, but there it's explicit. Unklus Hager, he's called Unklus the convert, so that's not particularly controversial. But this is an interesting example and has very, very serious implications, as we'll see. So the Gemara in Baba Basra gives a few interesting examples of, you know, the descendants of such and such wicked person ended up being great sages. So it says the great grandchild of Haman ended up teaching Torah in Bnei Brak, and it lists who that individual was. And one of the examples that it gives, it says Bnei Banav Shel Sancheriv. That the descendants of Sancheriv, the Assyrian general, king rather, who came and almost conquered Jerusalem, they ended up teaching Torah in Jerusalem. So says the Gemara, who were these descendants of Sancheriv that taught Torah in Jerusalem? These were Shmaya and Avtalion. Shmaya and Avtalion were the descendants of the Assyrian king, and they ended up being great sages and leaders of the Jewish people. So I want to focus here on the opinion of the Rambam regarding this statement. So there are two sources, just very, very quickly. It's one line from each one. So the first one is the introduction to Mishneh Torah. So over here, the Rambam, he just kind of like, you know, peruses over this thing. And he says, this is the wrong one. Right. And he's listing, right. He's listing, the different sages that exist in the time of the early Tanaic period. Mehen Raman Gamliel, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, All of these, Mibnei Shfatia ben Avtiel ben David. All of these were from the royal family, the descendants of David. The Eile Shiva Chachamim Kvar Yisbar Shehim Yizera David. All these sages that we listed, they were all from the house of David. Umehem Arba Mikahal Hagerim. But there were four other very, very famous sages that were from the community. That's literally what that means. Kahal, the community of converts. Shmaya, Avtolion, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Meir. Those very four famous sages who were like the leaders of the generation, okay, they were from the community of converts. So here the Rambam doesn't specify what he means when he says community of converts. The Gemara says explicitly that Rabbi Akiva's father Yosef was a convert. And it also says by Rabbi Meir that his grandfather or great-grandfather was like a Roman official, perhaps even related to the emperor, but he himself was not a convert. Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Meir were for sure not converts. That's what the Gemara says explicitly. But Shmaya and Avtolion, he leaves kind of ambiguous. However, in his introduction to Mishneh Torah, not the introduction to the Mishnah, the Rambam says explicitly right over here, Shmaya and Avtolion, Gerei Hatzedek. Shmaya and Avtolion were Assyrian converts, which is unbelievable. And it's unbelievable for two reasons. First of all, the Gemara we don't find in Chazal explicitly that they say such a thing, whereby other times they do, right? Like by Unklus Hager, for example, they call them Unklus the convert. Shmaya and Avtolion, they don't call them Shmaya and Avtolion the converts. But the other reason why it's so fascinating is, who were Shmaya and Avtolion? Who were these people? So they were one of the zugot, one of the pairs. There was many generations of Jewish people where the Jewish people were led, the top two sages, they were pairs. One was the Nasi, functioned as like the president, which had some type of pseudo-political status, and the Av Beit Din, the head of the Sanhedrin. Those were the zugot. One guy was the Nasi, one guy was the head of the Sanhedrin. Now, can you be the head of the Sanhedrin if you're a convert? You can't be the head of the Sanhedrin. You can't even be a regular guy in the Sanhedrin. You can't even be on a regular Beit Din if you're a convert. So how can the Rambam say that Shmaya and Avtolion were both converts when they both officiated on the highest court in the land? This is an unbelievable question. This one little comment of the Rambam has generated many, many theories about how to reconcile this. So one answer that's given by the Knesset HaGedolah, which is an important compilation of different achronim, on the order of the Shulchan Aruch. So he brings an interesting answer. It may sound a little bit forced, but it does have basis in Chazal, as we'll see in a moment. The Knesset HaGedolah says an interesting answer. He says that there is a din that we learn in the Gemara in Sanhedrin of Kiblu Alayhu. What does that mean? It means that even if a dayan is technically invalid and he's not allowed to be, by the strict letter of the law, he's not allowed to officiate as a judge, if the two litigants agree that they're willing to accept this person as the judge, then he can be the judge. So let's say, the example that the Gemara gives is that, right, if you have two litigants and the father of one of them is a big Talmud Chacham. So that's Kiblu Alay Avicha, right? So the litigant says, okay, I accept your father to be the judge in our case. I accept him, right? Even though he's your father and technically a person who's related to one of the litigants is invalid, I accept him. So you're allowed to accept him. So the Knesset HaGedolah says an unbelievable thing. He says that Shmaya and Avtolion were accepted organically and unanimously by the entire Jewish people. Now, this might sound a little bit strange, and I agree that it does sound a little bit far-fetched. However, when we see the description in Chazal of Shmaya and Avtolion about who they were and the persona that they had and how the Jewish people related to them, it sounds a lot less far-fetched. The Gemara talks about, for example, a story when Shmaya and Avtolion were walking through the streets of Jerusalem, and the Kohen Gadol was walking from the other direction. And the whole community of Jerusalem was walking behind the Kohen Gadol. And then they all spotted Shmaya and Avtolion. And in mass, like pack rats, they all ran away from the Kohen Gadol in order to accompany Shmaya and Avtolion, because they were just beloved figures. For some reason, Shmaya and Avtolion were just these beloved, likable people. They didn't have any controversy surrounding them. Everyone just loved and respected them. So this idea that there was this organic acceptance of them as the leaders of the Jewish people, despite the fact that they were converts, it does not sound so far-fetched. However, it does sound a little bit forced, because how could you say that, you know, they took a poll like every single Jew in the land of Israel at that time, you know, accepted Shmaya and Avtolion? So it does seem a little bit far-fetched. The other answer that I heard
said that there was no public protest, and therefore by default
Correct, correct. Yes, that's actually a very good answer. Right. There's a Shuvah of the Chassam Sofer that talks about this. Someone sent him a question regarding a vote, a community vote that took place in the shul 1 week, and like 20 people showed up to the vote. Like, not too many people showed up, and on the basis of the vote of 20 people, they made a decision. So a bunch of people that protested and they said, "Wait a minute, only 20 guys showed up. Like, what about the rest of us that didn't show up?" So says the Chassam Sofer, if there was an announcement that there was going to be a vote on this critical issue and everyone knew about it and everyone had the opportunity to show up, the people that showed up, they're the majority. So, right? It's decided on the basis of the people that show up. It's kind of like an election, right? The people that decide to vote. So those are the people that determine the outcome of the election.
Well, it reminds me of Kuleyama. Kuleyama might be the two guys sitting there discussing the topic.
Yeah. Listen. I mean, you're talking about when the Gemara says like Kuleyama, like there it is kind of giving a broad view of like the consensus of scholarship at the time, like the poll.
Well,
like,
I'm extrapolating that to the space. The Kuleyama, they were accepted because there was no.
I think how you're applying it now, that when you have a decision that needs to be made for the public, and the public have the opportunity to protest or weigh in or give their opinion, and they don't, so that is tacit agreement. That's like tacit acceptance of the situation, which could be very relevant. There's another very, very important
from a line of converts, so it's not direct. I mean, like it's their
great. So you could say that, which is, again, it kind of jives more with how the Gemara portrays the lineage of Shammai and Avtalion, because it doesn't say that they themselves were converts. However, the Rambam says that he has a tradition that Shammai and Avtalion were themselves converts, which is really fascinating. The other answer, which is very, very important, which highlights a theme that we've touched on in the past, is an answer that's given by the Urim V'Tumim, Rav Yonasan Eibeshetz. We mentioned Rav Yonasan Eibeshetz last week, and I didn't have the details off the top of my head. Rav Yonasan Eibeshetz was an important figure in the early to mid 1700s. He was the chief rabbi of Prague, right? Both a mystic and a very important halachic decisor in the Jewish people. So Urim V'Tumim was the book that he wrote on Choshen Mishpat, and he gives a very, very interesting answer as to how Shammai and Avtalion could officiate in their positions. So he says like this. He says the zugot were not these rabbis that functioned as the pairs throughout Jewish history. Yeah, Shammai and Hillel, Shammai and Avtalion, all these people. So they weren't regular, dayanim that just happened to occupy a position on the Beit Din. They were much more like political figures, and because the political situation of the Jewish people at that time was essentially a vassal state of the Persian Empire or the Greeks or whoever happened to live there. So essentially they were being appointed for political positions. They were being appointed for political positions, okay? And when you're being appointed for a political position, so if the non-Jewish authorities appoint you as in within their system of governance, so you're allowed to officiate in that capacity, right? To be a dayan, to be like a regular dayan on a regular Beit Din, it's true. A convert is not allowed to occupy that position. But because these were essentially political positions and not really the classical dayan, like someone who helps convene a Beit Din, so that's why Shammai and Avtalion were allowed to occupy the positions that they were in. Which is a very interesting answer for a number of reasons. First of all, it sheds a lot of light on what that means when we say, the zugot, the pairs, one of them was the head of the Beit Din and one of them was the Nasi. Like it gives some like almost like some geopolitical insight into what.
Well, I would have thought just the opposite. Because of the geopolitics involved, you can't have a Nasi, which is like the prime minister, representing the Jews, now being as head of the yeshiva. So you'd think likewise. And maybe on a regular Beit Din, Pascha and Halacha, that might make sense. But a political role who represents the Am Yisrael, it's shocking that, that's what I'm saying, they must have come from a line of descendants. Because the only illusion we have is that one comment, there's that one line you read. And someone who didn't like them made that comment. It was a little bit rude in public.
Which comment?
The guy that says, you're sons of converts.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only line we have.
I know, right? But I think it also reveals like what the role of the Sanhedrin was. Because the Sanhedrin itself wasn't a court that was functioning day in and day out in like regular disputes. You have like a regular Beit Din of a town. So like they're dealing with the day in and day out responsibilities of you know, people that live in that area and like their daily issues. The Sanhedrin was not dealing with that type of stuff. They were like the Supreme Court, you know, in a way. That's like, that's a pretty good comparison. The actual cases that they took were very, very few and far between. The Sanhedrin was not functioning as like, as a regular court that was just.
Well, wouldn't you expect them, Dafka, the Supreme Court members, that they should be, full blood? I mean, what do you want to call it? You know, full blood Jews.
Listen, I hear you. I hear you. Which is why I think that the first answer that we saw before of the Knesset HaGedola, that it was just that they were so popular that these two individuals, for one reason or another, they were just so beloved and so popular that there was just no opposition whatsoever to their being appointed to this role. Right?
It also could be a nasty comment to the Kohen Gadol.
That Hillel Hazaken, who was a direct descendant of David, he went and studied under these people. That's what the Gemara in Pesachim tells us, that Hillel was, right, he was from Babylonia originally, Hillel. He comes from Babylonia to Israel in order to study under these people.
But I think under the Roman times, the Jews bought and sold the kahuna, Kohen Gadol. And maybe this
true.
Is more of a comment.
This was before that.
One generation before that situation.
Yeah, like one or two generations. Yeah.
It's not before Pompey conquered Jerusalem.
Is it before? No, it's not before Pompey conquered it.
Nope.
I don't know exactly when Chazal saw the Kahuna Gedola descending into a purely political appointment. I don't think it was immediately after the Roman occupation. I don't know. I just don't know enough about
the anti-Hasmonean. It could be anti-Hasmonean. But the point being, it's really a poke at the Kohen Gadol more so than a perk to these descendants of converts. You know.
Well, I think that in either way, it's trying to demonstrate the point of Chazal when they bring that story is not only to poke at the Kohen Gadol, but it's also to show the reverence that people had for these people. Listen, if the people were willing to take the time in order to show their reverence for a guy who was a puppet of the Roman government out of like fear of reprisal, so that if they took the time to do that, and when they see Shmaya and Naphtali walking down the street, they all leave. They all leave in order to show reverence to them. That I think does show the position, so to speak, that these people occupied, that these people played. I think just in the popular conception, they were just beloved, respected individuals, and that's how they were able to occupy this position, right? So I think these two ideas of the Knesset HaGedola, of the right, this incredible popularity and respect that Shmaya and Naphtali had, coupled with this idea that Rav Arbashetz gives us that when we have a position that has a pseudo political authority, so the rules are slightly different. I think that this sheds light on this approach. I think that it's also important to highlight that I saw recently in the Maharal, in his commentary on Maseches Avos, that he says. He actually brings this opinion of the Rambam that Shmaya and Naphtalion were themselves converts. And the Maharal says, not possible. It's just totally not possible. I don't know how anyone in their right mind could suggest such a thing. Chazal don't say that that's the case. It says that they were the descendants of, the Assyrian king, but it doesn't say that they themselves were Assyrian converts. So, okay, you could take it or leave it. It certainly doesn't seem to be the prevalent approach who Shmaya and Naphtali were. But what's important for our discussion is that all of these ideas that have been generated in order to respond to the Rambam's opinion are relevant because they do shed light on like the more theoretical aspects of the conversation about how converts, you know, function or don't function within the context of a Beit Din.
Do we have a hint of this today in the way that FFBs might relate to converts, children of converts, when it comes to Shidduchim, that somehow they ascribe something that's not 100% to people?
Listen,
like
I think it's important. I think it's important to be explicit about these things. There are some considerations that people have that are petty, and some considerations that aren't petty. The Gemara in Yevamos, not the same Gemara that we quoted before, but an earlier one, makes the very seemingly harsh comment that Kashin Gerim Lisrael Kasapachas, that the Jewish people are difficult, that, excuse me, that converts are difficult for the Jewish people, like a leprosy lesion. Okay, that's not putting it lightly. That's pretty hard. So there's different understandings of what this means. Okay, so I believe Rabbeinu Bachai says, and this is Rabbeinu Bachai, he says that one of the aspects of why it's so difficult is kind of like a Yonah situation. Like he runs away from Nineveh because he doesn't want to make the Jewish people look bad. It's like these converts, they come from idolaters, right? They grow up in churches, what have you, right? They're like worshiping idols. And they wake up one day, it's like, no, this is all Sheker. I'm going to worship the one true God of Israel. So that makes the Jews look bad. And it kind of does. You see, right? I remember years ago listening to a convert, I believe his name is Whitman. He was a doctor of theology of all things. He studied theology in Germany and like he was a pastor for many years. Like a real hardcore idol worshiper. And one day he woke up, he's like, I want to be Jewish. So he's one day he's talking to one of his old pastor buddies back from Germany. And, he's talking to him about like the lies of the New Testament and the Christian doctrine, et cetera, et cetera. And the pastor friend says to him, he says, okay, answer me one question and I'll come with you to be Jewish. Answer me one question. Why don't the Jews take this seriously? And he didn't have an answer for him. Yeah. So it's like these people who come and they're taking it seriously. They had no reason to take it seriously, but out of their own volition, they take it extremely seriously. They kind of make us look bad. So that's like one perspective. But the other perspective, which is a little bit more simple, which is what Tosfos says on the spot, it says, listen, these people come in with certain cultural baggage, cultural background that doesn't necessarily comport with what is normal and right amongst the Jewish community. Now, is that a blanket statement on every single convert that we're all automatically going to judge them for that? Absolutely not. Chas v'shalom, right? Like, God forbid that we should cast judgment on an individual because of the possible trends of a certain phenomenon. That's called stereotyping. I'm sure we've all heard of that idea, right? So obviously not.
How can we say that we love the ger?
The mitzvah that's mentioned the most in the entire Torah. This is ammunition for people with a certain political bent, but it happens to be true. The mitzvah that mentioned in the Torah the most is to take care of the ger. That's the, I believe it's mentioned 36 times in the Torah. That's like a lot. It's more than Tiyatz Mitzrayim. It's more than learning Torah. It's like, it's mentioned a lot, right?
So, in light of that, Shammai, how would the Syrian community as a whole community say we do not take convert, you cannot marry our daughters?
No. So that's a very good question.
Oh, the person tomorrow where the guy says the ger is great, but not for my daughter.
The historical backdrop to this was that people, there were many, many instances, not just like one or two. There was like a whole trend of people that were bringing in, you know, which were essentially goyim in order to marry them, and like going through a kangaroo court of conversion in order to just, you know, seal the deal. So they made this blanket, this blanket prohibition. Perhaps you can critique it to say that the situation is different today than it was back then. Okay, fine. So maybe that's a relevant critique. But the origin of this blanket ban has very, very strong precedent in terms of what was going on in the community at the time. The Gemara says, this is slightly more well-known. The Gemara says, and in the time of Mashiach, we won't accept converts. In the time of Shlomo HaMelech, he didn't accept converts either. Why not? Because all the people were coming in order to just, you know, join the party. Things were so good that it was clear that people weren't doing it lishma.
Can someone go to a Beit Din and say, my child is not being allowed into this school because we're converts, and the school admits it? Sure, that's the reason. Is that actionable in a Beit Din?
So I don't think that such a thing is actionable from the perspective of Beit Din. From what angle would you be able to make such a lawsuit? Perhaps you could say that if the school is a communal facility, and the people that live in that community and function in that community and are part of the community for all other aspects, they have a right to be there. So in that sense, it could be actionable, but outside of that, I would think it would be very, very difficult for it to be really solidly actionable from the perspective of a Beit Din. I do think that communities, and this has happened in the past, the communities can make policy decisions, right? Collectively, they can decide to make policy decisions on their institutions and say, listen, we do not discriminate, on the basis of this or this. And if you do, then you're violating the right the bylaws of the city. It's not a Beit Din issue; it's a communal issue, and that absolutely should be done. Again, this goes back to the story that we mentioned right in the book of Vayikra that talks about this ger situation. That technically speaking, the people were right. Listen, his father is an Egyptian; he has no right being here. So technically, they're 100% right. Okay, fine, you're technically right, but you can't find a solution for this guy, really. You can't figure out a place for him to pitch his tent. How much space are we talking over here? Okay, 4 square meters, 5 square meters, right? So they're technically right. They're technically right. And that's what the Midrash says. Yatza mi beis dino shel Moshe Rabbeinu. He leaves the court of Moshe. Moshe rules against him. He's saying, listen, I want a place to put my tent. And Moshe rules against him. He says, listen, you don't have a spot because your father's an Egyptian. So he ruled against him. And still, there was this tremendous kitrug, so to speak, on the Jewish people, this tremendous judgment against the Jewish people that they couldn't find a solution for this guy. So this speaks to the general theme again. We keep on coming back to this theme. I think it's important to emphasize it over and over again, how we should not conflate the fundamental righteousness of the society with how Beit Din functions. Beit Din functioning is a tool, one of the tools that society has in order to function well. But to think that the Beit Din is going to be the end-all, be-all of making a just society, that's having way too much faith in the system. And as we're told time and time again, right, it's our initiative that ends up keeping tzedakah and mishpat in the world. And Bezrat Hashem, all these things should remain theoretical anyway, so we won't have to resort to Beit Din, and we can just work things out in the most organic way possible. Bezrat Hashem. Tov.
How does it work today in Israel? The Beit Din paskens one way, and the second court another. Take this case just recently, Yom Kippur in Tel Aviv. Let's say your Beit Din would say it's perfectly appropriate. We give you permission and right to put up an outdoor synagogue, mechitza, and then the second says no. Like, where does the authority actually rest in the public domain on questions like that?
I mean, you're asking a practical question, or you're asking a halakhic question? What perspective are you asking?
How does it work in Israel? I mean, what is the law here?
For sure, the secular court goes over. Listen, if a person goes to Beit Din, as we mentioned before, when people go to Beit Din, they sign a legally binding document that can be enforced by the secular authorities if they decide not to go through with it. But if in a situation where Beit Din makes a ruling that ends up being contrary to the secular court, to the secular law or whatever, then of course the secular law takes precedent. I think that this case that happened in Tel Aviv wasn't a conflict of Beit Din versus secular court. It was an agreement, a tacit agreement that was developed amongst the people that participated in this prayer in Tel Aviv, and someone complained, so the court got involved. Listen, Rahmana Litzlan, God should save us from these things. It's unbelievable, unbelievable. And we should not have to bring it up ever, because these things are really, really, they do not make us look good. They do not make us look good at all. And please, God, I hope that we can keep these incidents to a minimum, and we should not bring them up, because this is very, very strong din on the Jewish people when we see these types of things happen, where we have secular authorities essentially banning Jewish practice. That's essentially what's going on. They're banning traditional practice of Torah.
And they would not have banned a Muslim group for the same topic.
Right. I mean, we could go on all day about how ludicrous the situation is, but it's best not to think about it. I think that's just the best approach. It's important to be cognizant of this in order to add another layer of awareness as to why the system is as dysfunctional as it is. But to leave it on the side, we should merit to go into Sukkot with tremendous simcha and not have to think about these things.
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Shammai. Thank you very much. And a belated happy birthday to you.